Welcome to the current federal tax developments for the week of December the 30th, 2019. And this week we're going to take a break from our normal structure. We're going to take a look at the year's big tax developments. And part of the reason for this is, A, we are now not only at the end of a year, but the end of a decade. We want to kind of look back on where we've come from and maybe what's significant. And also, to be honest, a couple of other reasons is, number one, not a whole lot big's happening right here at the end of the year. Not surprisingly, the IRS has slowed up issuing guidance here the last couple of weeks of December. We have seen, you know, the big thing that probably came out the last week, if we're going to try to really have a headline for this week, would have been an IRS memorandum that indicates that they're not going to include 199 Cap A when they do substitute full return calculations. My take was I never really expected them to. Secondly, I don't worry that much about that thing. And third, if that's our big item, we really don't have much to talk about. And the other issue was I am recovering from a cold that had me feeling not so wonderful during the holiday season. And we also have the fact that, yeah, it was a holiday season, so getting things all written up nicely and taken care of, if there had been something to write about, was also not something we had a ton of time on. So we're going to go ahead and kind of look back maybe and just review, as we're getting ready for a new tax season, what were the big things that hit us this past year, and maybe what we should be considering right now about how this impacts our practices going forward. I do want to remind you that we do have coming up in the next couple of weeks a couple of sessions here, and these sessions are going to be related to the new tax bill that we got at the end of 2019. On January the 8th, the Arizona Society of CPAs will run a four-hour both live in person at their offices in Phoenix and online, which is available wherever you may be sitting. You know, I suppose if you're sitting in Paris right now, taking time off before tax season, and you want to stream it, given the time zone differences, but you want to stream it to Paris, that's fine. You know, we've got that going on. That'll be on January the 8th. We'll also be doing the same session as a webinar only for the Idaho Society of CPAs. That'll be on January 14th. Now, both the Arizona Society and the Idaho Society are currently running on Mountain Standard Time for the most part, so you're going to have to adjust your schedules for the start times. As I recall, the Arizona one will start at 8 a.m. Mountain Time. The Idaho one will start at 8:30. So if you are in Paris, adjust based on your time zone there. Otherwise, please visit the websites for them, the Arizona Society at www.ascpa.com or the Idaho Society at www.idcpa.org. And you'll find information there about signing up for the courses on the dates we're talking about. And again, what we plan to do is spend 4 hours discussing what was in the year in law. We also plan to give you access to a PDF that I think is going to be around 110 pages of material that actually has the text-based backup for what were in the various provisions found in this law, so kind of a reference manual to work from as well, in addition to our time talking about it online. Well, let's talk about the year in review now, 2019. This is scheduled to go up on Monday, you know, to be basically, that's the release date officially. Probably will go up a little before that on Sunday night. But we're sitting here just with, at best, you know, a little over 48 hours to go before the year ends. And by the time you listen to this, it may very well even have ended. But we want to take a look at 2019, the year, because we've got this quiet period the last week of the year. So what happened this year? A lot happened to 2019. 2019 was a year following the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So we want to take a look at the impact for things that primarily how I'm rating these things that happened this year is based on the impact on people that have attended my sessions during the year, that respond to me online, and that I believe are probably listening to this product as well. So this is not going to be the perspective you would get if you're in a corporate tax department. This is probably not the perspective you'd get if you're in the tax, in a tax version, in some part of tax, working for a Big Four firm. It's going to be a little different view. We're looking at primarily privately held businesses is going to be where a lot of my concern is. I am interested in how it impacts that. I'm not as concerned about international issues. Yes, I worry a little bit about GILTI and have a few issues that have come up there in my practice. You know, I don't worry about the beat. The beat does not impact any of my clients, not close to impacting any of them, so I'm not worried about that. So I don't worry as much about heavy international issues, so I'm not looking at those. And I focus on pass-throughs rather than C corporations. So this is not saying that this is the top five for everybody, or that this is what should be considered the most significant. Generally, I'm not a tax policy geek, so I'm not here to tell you about what's the most important tax policy issues going on. I mean, obviously, the controversies that have been going back and forth and people spend a lot of time yelling about, you know, the limitation on deduction on state and local taxes, that's consumed a lot of tax policy bandwidth. I'm not sure, though, I'm terribly concerned about it from our perspective. We're mainly interested here in the mechanics of making things work. Not so much, I'm not that worried about the policy side. For me, the policy side's an issue that is meant to be discussed in other forums, not this one. There are plenty of other forums to discuss it. Go at it. Well, let's start with my number one. I thought, should I do this as a countdown or should I just start with the top? And I thought, let's start with the top because this program is meant to be primarily something of use to you in your practice, not necessarily this thing that's trying to get you to hang around to listen to a bunch of ads in the middle. So we'll get credit for that because we're going to keep you there until the last thing comes up. I'm going to, you know, put the very key thing at the end. For me, there was a little question what the biggest development of the year was because a little question what the biggest provision was and what in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that was impacting my clients. And that was the Section 199 Cap A 20% deduction for pass-through activities. Remember, we got final regulations on this, Treasury Decision 9847. We got the final regs on January the 18th. And that was kind of an issue for a lot of us because that was just before we had to actually start doing tax season work. We had a few hundred pages of regulations to comb through, and we had very, very little time to comb through them. So that was an issue. The timing was less than thrilling. We knew at that time, we knew coming into the year that the regulations were under review. We knew we should have them before tax season started. We didn't know how close we'd get. Obviously, middle of January, virtually the same day that, you know, the IRS started accepting returns for the year, we got the final regulations on 199 Cap A, right? And good news, bad news, they didn't make huge changes to the proposed regs. We had all spent most of 2018 looking at the proposed regs, figuring out how they would work, and trying to apply them to our client base. And we had been told by then that, of course, we could rely on those 18 regs for 2018 tax year. Now, that's probably the first key takeaway. Remember, this year we cannot rely on the 2018 proposed regs. This year, your only option is to use the 2019 final regulations when we're dealing with 199 Cap A issues. And that means some of the changes are important because this year, those changes now become mandatory. Not one, if you said, you know what, I want to follow the proposed regs all the way, I could just ignore them. And some of those changes, remember, the IRS in the final regulation kind of patched something that maybe they should have thought of at first, but they failed to. The original regulation simply said if a trade or business, if you are renting property to a trade or business, that the rental that's under common control, the rental would automatically be a trade or business. In the final regulations, they changed a couple of parts of that. First thing is they made a minor change as to who's a related party, and they went with our more standard tax rules under 267 and 707, which are always the standard related party rules. And, you know, you may not recognize the sections right off. When you start looking at the list of related parties, it's like, yeah, okay, I know. Those would always tend to be the related parties. Originally, the proposed regs had some sort of family definition. They modified that. They went with the others. That's fine. Big thing, though, they did was they changed the rule to say that the thing you were renting to had to be a pass-through under common control, not just any business under common control. So that meant if you were leasing property to a C corp, under the proposed regulations, that rental was always a trade or business, and that was really helpful because a lot of these rentals tend to be triple net leases. And we know from lots of places that the IRS does not believe at least a single triple net lease is ever going to be a trade or business. So we have that taken care of very quickly. Now we're told, sorry, if you were leasing to your C corporation that's under common control, you last year could have said, I'm going to use proposed rates for everything. I could have got my 20% of my triple net lease. I'm fine. This year, we've got a problem if that thing's still a C corp. So either you change your lease in some way, shape, or form to remove it from the triple net category, or you are going to live with probably not having that deduction this year. Other change that affects some health professionals, especially certain pathologists, and those who are radiologists, who are basically paid to read data but don't actually see patients and treat patients. The original definition of healthcare and proposed regs did not require you to see patients to be in healthcare. The final regulations basically, or I should say the proposed regs required you to see patients or you weren't in healthcare. And why is that big? Because if you're not in healthcare, healthcare is a specified service trade or business. So if you were a physician, let's say a radiologist that merely read x-rays but didn't see patients, then the argument went, even if you had $1 million of taxable income, it was fine. The fact it was an SSTB didn't hurt you in the least because you weren't SSTB. So you could get your 20% deduction at least as long as you had W-2 wages to cover it. Now, in 2019's returns and later, that radiologist is going to be in healthcare. That's going to be a specified service trader business. And again, remember, we don't have the option to switch this year. We also, in the final regs, didn't get something we had hoped for. We did not get and I use the term useful safe harbor, or a definition for a rental trader business. We did get a safe harbor. The safe harbor was in proposed forms. It became final later in the year. If you are in the Second Circuit, I can kind of see a reason why that might be something that's useful kind of to you. But outside the Second Circuit, I don't see that being useful at all. Why? My take is simple. If you're anywhere close to meeting the requirements for the safe harbor, under the case law that we've had outside the Second Circuit, you already had a trader business. There's no question. Don't worry about the safe harbor. It's garbage. It's useless. It's like having a safe harbor that says LASIK is, LASIK procedure is going to we'll do a safe harbor, and that'll be considered an example of a medical expense on Schedule A. Well, we already know it's a medical expense on Schedule A. It meets all the requirements. Who cares? And that's the bottom line about the safe harbor. Now, in the Second Circuit, with the Greer case and the uncertainty we have about trader business based on that, okay, there, maybe I think the safe harbor is somewhat useful. But again, the Second Circuit is talking about New York and Connecticut. So outside of that, if you're not listening to me, from those locations, or your clients aren't those locations, then, yeah, I think it's one of the most useless things we've gotten. And by the way, I would say that if I had to select the most overhyped tax development for the year, it would be the rental safe harbor. Outside the Second Circuit, I think it has radically been overhyped. I think people have cared a lot about it, and it really, really should never matter. That really just shouldn't be a problem. We also got some clarifications on the treatments of adjustments to income. What I mean by that is, in the original proposed regulations, we were told we had to reduce income or qualified business income by expenses related to the qualified business income. But we didn't really get a list of what that was. Specifically, our concern was, I wonder if that means self-employed health insurance, KEO and other retirement plan contributions, SEPs, etc., on the front page of the 1040. Did it mean the deduction for the self-employment tax? The final regulations have this as a clarification. And I said when the final regs came out, be careful there. If you think the proposed regs are going to let you ignore this, I don't think you're right. I think the IRS has put this in here the way it's worded. This is merely a clarification. It didn't change the basic sentence that said you cannot take expenses that are related to the trade or business. All they added was a for example type clause to put those in there. And as we'll discuss a little bit later, we did discover, that's how the IRS viewed that. So bad news was we got clarification that told us, at least on paper, the IRS always considered those to be reductions in QBI. The number two development for the year came what we talked about last week. The Further Consolidated Appropriations Act 2020, we spent the whole year looking at a bunch of issues that we felt Congress should deal with in taxes. And they only dealt with one by the time we got to the later part of the year. So we got the Taxpayer First Act, that was it. And again, that one really didn't impact numbers on tax returns for the most part. That wasn't our problem. But we spent then the whole year looking at this, you know, the Secure Act, which was a big retirement plan bill that Congress had been working on for years and apparently agreed to. Passed the House overwhelmingly, but got stalled in the Senate. We had been looking at the questions of extenders. The extenders package, lots of things had expired at the end of 2017. Some things were that expired at the end of 2017, right? Some things expired at the end of 18. And Congress hadn't said if they were going to extend those things or not. In fact, and I don't like to drift into politics too often, but I think in this case it's pretty clear what was going on. You know, the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, Senator Grassley, I think it's pretty obvious he gave up the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, which he had in the prior Congress, to move to finance when that seat became open with Orrin Hatch retiring. He went to the Senate Finance Committee because he really wanted to make sure that the extenders for biofuels, and why is he concerned? He's from Iowa. Biofuels, they grow a lot of corn in Iowa. Corn is involved in biofuel credits. So he had a reason to want to get them through. So we spent the whole year worrying about would those ever get through. And we spent the year looking at, you know, some issues about some taxes that were in the Affordable Care Act. Would we finally get those repealed, which we thought would be? And, of course, and the other big thing was, would we get the technical corrections to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act? Well, I guess borrowing from an old Meatloaf tune, we can say in this case 3 out of 4 ain't bad. That's what we got. We got 3 of the 4 things did get kind of taken care of. And actually, we should probably say closer to 2.5 because extenders were more of a mixed bag. But the final very end before Congress left town, they gave us things. The biggest thing they gave us was that the Secure Bill finally became the Secure Act, became law. Right. Now, big thing to remember about the Secure Act, its major impacts are in 2020 and later. There are very, very, very few impacts in 2019, okay? And those tend to be a couple of retroactive correction issues or retroactive change issues for relief for certain things, like community newspaper relief goes back, I think, a couple of years. Reality is most of you aren't dealing with community newspaper plans, so I doubt that's actually a big issue for you. So for the most part, it's 2020 stuff, but it's big what's there. Big takeaway for most of us is if we do any planning with clients, if your clients have done stretch IRA planning, most stretch IRA plans have to be radically reworked at this point. And we're seeing discussions already come up about how could you achieve a similar goal? You know, is it going to be good enough to get a 10-year push where I can put it into the trust and hold for 10 years? Is a 10-year push good enough? Or do I need to do something else? You know, do I go so far as to use something like a turbo remainder trust to still get a lifetime or at least longer term distribution from the plan or from the IRA account? And I mean, CRTs are, they're messy, and obviously you're giving up something there, and that's going to be a huge issue there. Do we want to look at using other forms? Do we want to do other things? I mean, there's lots of issues that come into play, but I think there's also lots of opportunities. We no longer had to live with the straitjacket that was the conduit IRA. But recall, too, will conduit IRAs have a place? They may still, for those limited categories, that can get a life expectancy payout. I just saw a discussion or a post come up on California's listserv where we discussed specifically about if you had a special needs trust for a person who met the requirement of disability for lifetime payouts, then yeah, we may be back to a conduit IRA there, where we'd be using a conduit trust, I should say, there to hold the IRA to meet the requirements so that we could look through, use the life expectancy and make it work. I mean, those would be the kind of things we'll be looking at this play. Other big change your clients will hit is, remember, the required beginning date goes to age 72. Don't forget, though, like I said, this doesn't take effect till 2020. And it will not help your client who turns 70 and a half this year. Not only will they have to take distribution for 2019, but even though they won't be 72 in 2020, they will still have to take the 2020 required distribution, because you have to be a person who has not obtained 70 and a half by the end of 2019. These people will have attained it. Since they've attained it, they're under the old rules. Now, the other thing to remember is, beginning in 2021, we expect, proposed regs are out on this, we're going to get a longer payout period based on life expectancy. The IRS is looking to update those tables. So that's also something to keep in mind that's changing. That was not part of the SECURE Act, but it's obviously going to have an impact same way. If you work with qualified retirement plans, we had a number of changes there, including the requirement to offer coverage to long-term part-time employees, but that has a really odd delayed effective date, especially if you don't want to do it at all. That's unique provisions. We have some rules involving lifetime payouts and offering annuity programs to your employees, some encouragements there. You know, there are various other things. There's some prohibitions of using credit cards to make plan loans, which sound like a really dumb idea. And Congress has agreed, yeah, it's a really dumb idea, so don't do it. So we have all kinds of neat things coming in, distributions for birth of a child or adoption of a child. We can get out of the 10% penalties to an extent there for doing those things. I mean, there's all kinds of interesting things buried in here that relate to qualified plans. Also, and this may be, and maybe I said two, you know, three out of four, well, 3+0.0001. We actually did get what's effectively, they're not calling it a technical correction because it really is a total undoing, but we're going to go back and revert the kiddie tax to the pre-tax cuts and jobs act rules for 2019 and later years. You can elect to use them for 2018 returns if you want to go back to amend. Why? Because it turns out there are kids, and the poster child group on this that came up first were the children who have had a parent that was killed in active duty. And, you know, they're currently probably are in a one-parent household now. Good chance of that. That one parent probably does not have huge earning capacity. That's often the case as well. So that parent's not earning a whole lot. The kid's being paid this annuity, which is actually fairly significant compared to their parents' earnings now, their surviving parents' earnings. And the problem with that was because they're having to use trust rates. In the past, that stuff's still kiddie tax related, but it was tied to the surviving spouse's rate. And let's say the surviving spouse's Mary, and, you know, Mary's income is at a relatively low level. She was in the lowest tax bracket, so the kid stays in a relatively low tax bracket. Everything was great. Now suddenly Mary is still paying very low taxes, maybe even none, but suddenly her kid is having to pay potentially at 37.5% if the kid's being paid more than $12,000 a year. And that quickly becomes a bit of a problem. So now we're going to back that off, forget the kiddie tax, and go back to the pre-Tax Cuts and Jobs Act kiddie tax rules. Bad news is you're still going to need the parents' returns now done, just like you did before last year, to do the kiddie tax returns. But the good news is we eliminate this particular problem. Otherwise, here in Bill, we got the extenders for some things, but not all. The big takeaway is that a number of them may require amending 2018 returns to get the benefits. Some of the big ones in the mix included the private mortgage insurance deduction. We get that. The cancellation of debt on mortgage debt, qualified home mortgage debt, that also was put in there, that relief from that. And the non-business energy credits. If your clients had any of that left, remember that's when it's capped lifetime, and most of my clients max it out anyway. But if they didn't, then we could still go back and get that for 2017. That's in the mix. Big takeaway, almost everything that's in here, except for biofuels, which was the big thing that, that the chairman wanted, Aside from biofuels, almost everything else in this bill expires at the end of 2020. So while we'll know for sure what's going to happen through the coming year, or if you're listening to this after Tuesday this year, we don't know, you know, what that's going to do once we get to 2021. And I suspect we will again be sitting in December of 2021, finally discovering if we have them or not, or maybe bad news, even like this time, will be in December of 2022, and we finally figure out what happened. Well, I hope it doesn't get that bad, but it's possible. Also, in the Further Consolidation Appropriations Act, the Cadillac tax and two other Affordable Care Act taxes officially bit the dust. That's not surprising. They weren't currently being collected. They had either never gone into effect or had been deferred. Reality is that we knew these things weren't going to probably stay around. It was just a question of when. We got rid of them. What did we miss? The TCJA technical corrections did not get passed. So we don't have those. So if you're waiting for, as you're probably aware, if you're waiting for the retail fix to get that qualified improvement property expensed immediately as bonus depreciation, yeah, still got it right. The third one I'm going to bring here is actually a whole series of developments that ended with, culminated with those 2019-66 on December the 9th, at least for now where we're at. This was a series of articles that became the most popular articles online on the current federal tax developments website, which is really interesting that we had them. The IRS in last year's 1065 instructions for 2018 tax year added a little paragraph stating, and some codes, that if a taxpayer had a negative tax basis capital account to begin or end 2018, you had to tell the IRS about that particular partner and put the negative numbers there to let them know. Now, people said they didn't have time to do it. They couldn't get that together. People were pushing them. They wanted to go into opportunity funds, etc. They needed their K-1s now. And so the IRS said, okay, fine, file your K-1s on 2018 returns. Don't worry about this rule with the 2018 return, but in order to keep from being penalized for not having filed a proper and complete tax return and being penalized on information return issues, which would be both failing to send a proper information return to your partner and failing to send a copy to the IRS, those are two separate penalties. You have to send the information about those partners with negative tax basis capital accounts to the IRS by March 15, 2020 for the 2018 returns. That is still in force as of right now. Notice 2019-20 deferred it to March 15th, but basically, yeah, otherwise not an issue. This then kind of, okay, we kind of dealt with that. We were there, but then the 2019 draft K-1s came out over the summer. And we discovered they only had tax basis capital accounts. That now every partner we had to report tax basis capital accounts, not just those that were negative. That was not taken well, shall we say. The issue was, what exactly did the IRS want? And to be totally honest, why, I think I know what they want. I think I've known all along. They did not help the matter by, in various contexts, giving what look like conflicting signals on the issue. The IRS has said, and I think this is closest to what they want and what I thought of, what most of you have been doing tax basis capital for your K-1s have probably been doing for years. They want you to do this 743B previously taxed capital calculation. Now you may say, wait a minute, I never heard that. What is that? I don't know what you talked about. Well, that's the one where you figure out how much would somebody get if we liquidated today. How much of a gain would they be allocated? Any gains are allocated from that sale today at fair value. Well, we subtract that off what they got. And then how many any losses they'd be allocated, we add those two. You make those two adjustments, get rid of the gains, get rid of the losses compared to what they would get. What you really found out was what was their tax basis, their share of the partnership's tax basis. That's a number I'm pretty sure they're after. But they indicated in a safe harbor option on the frequently asked questions that you could use outside basis adjusted to take debt out of the equation, which, by the way, may have nothing to do with the number I just talked about to you, right? There can be radical differences there. And then in the instructions to the 1065, they've kind of talked about, well, you know, you start with what you put in and you subtract out, you add in your additional amounts that have been that you've been allocated as income, you subtract out what you've, you know, got as losses, we take away your distributions. And while I understand that theory of how it works, that also doesn't make sense from the context somebody buys to an existing partnership from an existing partner. You know, are you, you know, they don't say, oh, you inherit their tax basis capital. So the IRS has been less than clear. They do swear that they're going to clarify this. But, and also everybody freaks out about how does the IRS plan to use the data. My own take with that is pretty simply, they're going to use it for examination purposes, and they're going to start asking people questions who have negative tax basis capital if they don't see an allocation of debt that's at least large enough to wipe that out. They're going to ask questions about, you know, why don't we see any, you know, losses that have been deferred? Why don't we see any gains from distributions reported on your returns? That's what they're probably going to do with it, let's be honest. Are there problems? Oh, yeah, there are going to be tons of problems because there's lots of answers there of why you could see a negative capital account and not have a problem with the issues IRS might think you should, but clearly that's what they're after. They also added other information requests on the return, more specifically 704C items that are in process. Now, you notice 2019-66, the IRS changed direction slightly. They said for the 2019 tax returns and the final versions of the K-1s, you know, and the 1065 for 2019, which are out now, basically have been modified to go this route, we got rid of saying it has to be tax basis capital. They just say partner's capital account. You are supposed to tell the IRS via an attachment what the basis is you're doing the capital account on. That'll be part of it, but they're not going to require for 2019, not going to require tax basis capital. They're obviously keeping that open for future years. You still will have to, though, this year for 19, just like 18, notify the IRS, anybody who has negative tax basis capital, tell the IRS how negative it was, both beginning and end of the year, and give that information to them. And this time, we do not have the option currently to defer that to a year later. This needs to go with this year's K-1. IRS theory was, we told you you needed this. You've had a year. You should have gotten your systems ready to do it. Number four on our list, back to 19 Cap A. The IRS, on the Frequently Asked Questions page, came up with some big things on April the 11th and November the 20th. The IRS this year announced they're going to start reducing sub-regulatory guidance. Now, good news, bad news. Sometimes be careful what you wish for. You might get it. The problem with what is sub-regulatory guidance? Talk about IRS notices, revenue rulings, revenue procedures, announcements. Now, the big negative of that, why some people have disliked that way of the IRS dealing with these things and other agencies doing it like that, is that unlike regulations that go through this exposure process, I'm thinking of GAAP at this point, but we go through a comment period, right? We open it up, we have comments, we have hearings, they take that information back, they modify, they go forward. When the IRS issues a revenue ruling or revenue notice, you know, revenue procedure, all they do is they just review it internally and then they publish it. There is no comment period, you know. While sometimes IRS will put one out for comment like they did for the safe harbor for rentals, most often the IRS just publishes them. So they're saying we're going to move away from that. We're going to kind of try to stop doing sub-regulatory guidance. But here's the catch. We still need that guidance. We need some guidance on things that will go beyond what the regulations go for because we are not adding to regulations. Right? Remember, we still have the two-for-one rule. If the IRS puts out a new reg, they have to basically repeal two others. That's still in play, so the IRS is not likely to do it. We have a move right now trying to reduce number of regulations, so now we're kind of stuck. This guidance is now popping up on these frequently asked questions on the IRS website. We got a big set of surprises, and a couple of which we really didn't like, on April the 11th when the IRS went. Remember, they had done the final regs on 19 Cap A. That's it. Everything's been written except for the cooperative portions. It's all been written. Okay, we're done. But there's still unanswered questions. On April the 11th, the IRS snuck in this frequently asked questions, expanding it dramatically. And that was when we found out about self-employed health insurance and S corporations and the double deduction problem. Yes, you have to deduct self-employed health insurance and competing QBI at the S corp level because it's a deduction of the corporation. But when the shareholder then finds out, you know, the shareholder gets that added back to their W-2, then they go do their personal return. They say, aha, I can claim it because I'm not covered by my spouse's plan, can't be covered by my spouse's plan, and, you know, I'm paying for the care, it meets all the requirements, we have the income, so I deduct it, now I have to deduct it again. Yes, you deduct it twice. No, that doesn't really totally make sense, but it may be the way the law works. But that's how the IRS told us this on that day on April the 11th. And as I said at the time, nobody was doing them that way at that time. We also found out, this way made it clear, the proposed regulations, you cannot use proposed regulations and ignore reducing your QBI by the SEP contribution for your Schedule C, or by the self-employed health insurance, or by the self-employment tax deduction. IRS made it clear that was a clarification, not a change, so we have that issue. The IRS continued with the facts. They had some decent clarification how pass-throughs work, and that simply made them work the way I thought they always did. The problem is your tax software may not have been doing that right, so we have a lot of problems. I think the April the 11th rules may have done a lot to change the way your tax software works. Later in the year, the IRS added sections in the facts to agriculture cooperative issues for 199 cap AG deductions and other related items there. That's a whole unique specialty. And finally, some really good long discussion about how rentals work with 19 Cap A. Still doesn't give us a nice, clear, this is what a trader business is in a rental, this is what one isn't. Aside from saying, go look at the safe harbor, which as I've already said, if you're close to it, you're a trader business. We know that already. That's not helping matters. But we did get that done. The key takeaway, though, is you've got to keep watching this frequently asked questions page. Finally, the number five issue I found this year, the states are now reaching out far more often. Wayfair provisions have been added by states all around the country. They're going to do Wayfair-based economic nexus rules. Virtually every state now that has a sales tax, I think there may be one or two holdouts in most, but virtually every state now has adopted a rule. Most of the rules try to follow to some extent what South Dakota did in Wayfair. So quite often you're going to find the $100,000 worth of sales, 200 sales into the state. You have to collect and report the sales tax. The 200 transactions is most often our nightmare because you can get far less than 100 grand worth of sales and have 200 transactions depending upon what you sell. And that's kind of an issue that a lot of our clients are running into. We've also saw the increase in marketplace rules. This complicates matters because now the problem becomes some marketplace states, it is up to Amazon and eBay to collect everything. They have all the liabilities, all the issues. In other states, the marketplace collects it. They're supposed to try to collect it, but if they fail to, the vendor still has to worry about it. Sometimes the vendor can opt out. We end up with a whole mess here about how the marketplace rules work. And a lot of small companies sell through the Amazons and the eBays of the world. And that means having to understand how the marketplace rules work for your reporting in all your various states. That makes it kind of nasty. And there still are states that don't have marketplace rules yet. So, yeah, it's in real flux. Sales tax has been in real flux. The states have also begun now flexing their muscle on income tax some more. You know, we've seen case law in California that looked to apply a unitary business model to an individual who was a screenwriter. In the Bindley case, that is interesting in that, as was pointed out in a tax analyst article this week, that Bindley applied to somebody who had less than $50,000 worth of income. $50,000 worth of income for a corporation would have been the trigger level before we might have to apportion. Apparently, being an individual, we apparently don't get those magic levels, or maybe not. Tough to tell how it works. The states start looking to expand their income tax reach. Now, the good news is the one Supreme Court case we got this year on whether a state had gone over broadly in taxing out-of-state operations was the case of North Carolina Department of Revenue versus Kimberly Rice Casener Trust. And the good news is the Supreme Court did find there are limits that North Carolina had crossed them, you know, had gone over the limits because there was not sufficient connection. But it was such a limited case issue. North Carolina claimed the right to tax any trust if there was a potential income beneficiary, potential current income beneficiary, who was a resident of North Carolina. North Carolina had a right to tax the income of the trust. Now, the Supreme Court says, no, that's not enough. She did not get a current distribution. She has no mandatory distribution. She might never get a distribution. North Carolina, then there's no property in North Carolina. The trustee's not North Carolina. No, they're not managing the trust in North Carolina. Sorry, you can't do it. The bad news is that really only affects one other state at this point. Technically, it affected two for refunds, Tennessee and Georgia. But Tennessee no longer taxes trusts. So really, it only affects Georgia and North Carolina. The court did not pick up a much broader case, the Fielding case out of Minnesota. And Minnesota Supreme Court had ruled that the state of Minnesota had overreached when it taxed a trust where the trustee, where basically the grantor had been a Minnesota resident when the trust was established, but now there was no Minnesota connection whatsoever. The trustee did not live in Minnesota. There was no property in Minnesota, no beneficiaries in Minnesota. There was nothing in Minnesota except that the benefit that the grantor had lived there when the grantor trust, when the trust became irrevocable. That would have been a much nicer and more important case to decide. We didn't get it. Okay. These continued changes have made a compliance nightmare for mid-sized and small businesses, especially though mid-sized, because that's the one where it's easy to have a bunch of states that clear the 200 level, have a lot of compliance issues, have a total mess, and not a lot of guidance. And that's been bad all year. We had other things happen this year. Let's not forget them, cover them quickly. Opportunity zones, we had lots of talk. But as Tony Nitti said in an article that he wrote for Forbes talking about the final regs we got just recently, I found the same thing he has. I've talked to way more people about opportunity zones than I've had people actually do anything with them. And that's been his experience as well. As he said, the amount of time he spent, you know, the amount, the actual clients who have done something that he's actually done some billable work on, he said he might have earned enough off the engagement for the firm to buy a printer. Yeah, you know, printers go pretty cheap these days, so that's not really, saying much. And I think that's my experience as well, experience almost every CPA I've talked to. And that's even if we just consider people who are investing it. It's an even smaller number when you talk about people that want to set one up and do one, you know, do their own. You can. Opportunity zones are great, but they're heinously complicated. There are lots of ways to foul them up. There are lots of foot faults that can cause you to lose the benefits. And, it's one of those things that's just really bad. I hate in this way. It is complicated. Something takes a lot of time to understand. Takes a lot of study to understand. If your client gets into one, you need to spend a lot of time studying in detail the regulations we just got. But the catch is, for the most part, you'll learn about it for that one client and you'll never have anybody else in them. That may change now that we've got the final regs out, but kind of suspect it won't, because I don't think most of my clients were not saying no because they weren't sure about the final regs. They're saying no because they didn't like that 10-year bit. We're still waiting on 163J guidance on the interest. This would be a big story if it was out, but it's not. We're going to really ask about, will we get any relief on the syndicate rules for those real estate partnerships that are about maybe have far less than $25 million of revenue, but they may be a syndicate under the tax rules. We've talked about that in the past. 163J is that many people, and I would agree, would consider this to be like the second biggest thing in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in terms of things that could affect businesses that we deal with regularly, and it's the second most complicated, shall we say, besides 199 Cap A. Well, we're waiting on that. You know, the regs have supposedly now been cleared, or they give in to the Office of Management and Budget. We're just waiting on the final regs to come out. Maybe they'll come out before the end of the year. Maybe it'll come out Monday and Tuesday, but I got news for you. I'm treating Friday, which was December the 27th. I'm treating that as the end of 2019 for this purpose. They come out on Monday or Tuesday. That's a 2020 development as far as I'm concerned, because it'll take us that long to have time to read them and do anything with them. We did get the Taxpayer First Act. That mainly changes procedures procedural issues, but if you do practice for the IRS, you should be aware of what's there. There are some nice things there, but again, most of it does not affect the number directly on the return. The IRS ran into a major problem case in May where it was ruled that they're ruling the difficulty of care payments received by a parent for caring for their adult child from Medicaid, that they had no right to say they were not taxable. That's a problem because they've said they're not taxable. People are not paying tax on them. But why the IRS ended up in court on that was because somebody still treated it as earned income for their income credit. Tax court said, yeah, it is. You have no right to do it. And oh, by the way, you forgot to argue death row and income if they were wrong. So we're still waiting to see what they're going to do about that. That's still up in the air. We don't know how the IRS is going to handle that one. The IRS continues challenging passive activity cases. That was a recurring theme throughout the year, either just whether you're materially participating at all if there's a loss, or they really like to go after people that claim to be real estate professionals. And most often, that's shooting fish in a barrel. They're going after people that anybody, just the very basic looking at what was going on, would have said there's not really any realistic chance they're going to meet the requirements to have more than 70 hours and more than half of their time be in a real estate activity. They're going to fail one or both of those. And yeah, it's been kind of obvious. IRS also has brought down the hammer on late filing penalties when something gets fouled up in electronic filing. We had two cases in 2019 that made it to the courts. Both cases, the district court ruled that, sorry, there's no protection. You know, if it's late filed, that's not reasonable cause. Taxpayer owes a penalty. The Fifth Circuit did send it back down for rehearing on whether the CPA had acted reasonably. And I have a feeling the way the facts that case are, the answer will be no. But the IRS is starting to push this. At least one tax court judge specifically questioned why they were doing that. She said, I understand the law. I understand that the law probably does mean the IRS could enforce these penalties. She just said, I don't understand, though, because that seems to be discouraging electronic filing. And that's not what I thought they were supposed to be doing. But nevertheless, keep an eye on what that happens there. That's a real problem for those of us who have to do electronic filing. And then don't forget, we just finished the decade. This was the decade. Think back to it. We started this decade. We're now at the end of the tens, right? We started the decade wondering, would AGTRA be made permanent, especially with the estate tax? The answer was, yeah, we got that in the end. We did. We had the bill that was supposed to get rid of extenders bills forever, the 2015 PATH Act. But that's not how it worked. We just had a extenders bill. Yeah, the PATH Act was not. We're going to make these permanent, we're going to make these other short-term extension, and then they're just going to die because once we want to make permanent, we just did, and that's not how it worked. Congress rewrote partnership exams in 2015 as well, but they put on a delay. That thing is now, right, it arrived last year, and the consequences will be hitting this year as the first exams start coming out eventually under this, and or as people discovered this year, if you discover a problem on last year's partnership return and your partnership did not opt out of the new partnership audit exams, centralized partnership audit rules, what the IRS will now refer to as BBA exams, you've got to go through that whole administrative adjustment request system and the whole rule of having to pick up that adjustment on the 2019 return. Since that'll be when you issued the amended K-1, at least if you get it done before the 31st, otherwise it'll be the 2020 return when we'll get that out on the partners, not going back and amending the 2018 return, I should say. So that was interesting. People have to deal with that finally. And we got the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act bill. It was finally passed after and I do consider this a problem. Again, back a little bit the mechanics of how the Senate works. Remember, they took the first reconciliation bill, they're going to do repeal and replace with that because that's going to be the easy bill. It turns out it wasn't the easy bill, never got done. Repeal and replace became repeal, replace, no, became fail, right? Didn't happen at all. But that burned a reconciliation bill. And why is that important? Had Tax Cuts and Jobs Act been the first bill, we could have done technical corrections as the second reconciliation bill. But as it stood, we'd already burned two. We really didn't have another one to burn, at least not easily. in order to clear up the problems of the TCJA. And the problems of the TCJA are big, and that's going to be the biggest thing going forward, is we're still dealing with those problems and those issues, those drafting errors that we know from the bill that the essentially the key author, the main, you know, kind of at least intellectual author, I realize the staffer actually wrote the bill, but Kevin Brady's, you know, technical corrections bill for TCJA was about 2/3 the size of the TCJA bill. There is a lot in there to be fixed. And unfortunately, there's not a good path for the moment to see how we get there. Well, again, last chance for your post-tax season, for pre-tax season CPE. Make sure you check online, check your courses, see what's happening, see what's coming up. We are going to have some of our California rebroadcasts coming up. If your state society is part of that, you can go ahead and check in and go there. What we're going to have is you can find out on January the 3rd, that is Friday, January the 3rd, coming up this week. We're going to be doing key tax planning concepts and issues. That's where we're talking about the various entity types. That will run at 6 a.m. Pacific and 8 a.m. Pacific. Adjust that for your time. Again, a lot of state societies offer the Cal program, so check in there. Also be offering then on the 15th of January the advanced partnership issues course, including that partnership audit regime that we talked about earlier. We're going to talk about how that works, some of the TCJA changes. This, again, will be 6 a.m. Pacific and 8 a.m. Pacific. And, again, adjust for your time zone. Check on your state society's website. These Cal courses may be offered by them, and you may be able to sign up through them to get these courses at a discount. Check that. Otherwise, you can check Cal CPA's website for these courses as well. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the decade, I guess it is, of the 2010s. We can say, or at least the year of 2019, or the week of December 30th, which is our more traditional view. Next week, we'll be back to looking at probably developments since the last time we did a regular weekly version, which goes back about 2 weeks ago. So we'll cover developments on there coming forward. Again, not much has happened. Very minor things, although, yeah, there are probably three things I could talk about. Plus the Opportunity Zone regulations, which probably at least discuss next week somewhat as those final regs. So you can follow us there. Follow us for updates on the website at currentfulltaxdevelopments.com. If you have any comments, send them to me, Ed Zollers at currentfulltaxdevelopments.com. Follow me on Twitter. That's at Ed Zollers. Also, I participate in discussions. You can go to the Reddit group /r/taxpros in Reddit, our subreddit. Or you can follow me on the Connect groups for the Arizona, Minnesota, and New Jersey Society of CPAs, or I also take a look over at Cal CPA's Tax Talk group. And if you want to know how to get involved in Tax Talk, probably the best thing to do is email me, because it does take a little bit of work to get in there now these days, but you will be approved to get in if you're a licensed CPA in any of the states. So, you know, be sure to check that. Otherwise, I will be back here presumably next week. I'll find something to talk about by that time. And we'll talk about what's been going on. And I look forward to seeing you in my last few CPE courses coming up, as I will be going to Portland, Oregon area there to do a real estate partnership course coming up the second week in January, at least the first full week, second week of January per se. I'll be doing some courses in Arizona as well. I'll be doing those coming up and do a couple of in-house sessions. So it's going to be an interesting time. And again, if you make those online courses for the year-end tax bill, I think there's important stuff there that you really should be thinking about before tax season. We do those 2 4-hour sessions, so consider signing up for those. And otherwise, like I say, I'll see you next week as we talk about whatever happens going on even more in the area of current federal tax developments.